This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Can you hear me now? All right, good, okay. You know, my daughter is 5 years old and she's been told this thing that she has to be loud and proud, so I'm gonna be loud, if not proud. Okay, so what I'm going to do today is lay out a kind of a roadmap for you. I'm going to tell you why India is authoritarian or how India is becoming more authoritarian, and I'm going to tell you that story through the life of India's political prisoners. Often the word political prisoners is used to describe dissenting voices, resisting communities in countries often considered foundationally authoritarian, like China, Russia. Freedom House published a report on authoritarianism this year. And if you look at that report, you find India mentioned, India and the United States and other countries like Israel mentioned somewhere far towards the end. So I'm going to tell you that authoritarianism is not something that only exists in countries that we think are quote and unquote evil or countries that we go to war with. Authoritarian ideas, fascist ideas are here in the world's oldest democracy, in the world's largest democracy, India, or the only democracy, Israel, that is in the Middle East, right? So I'm going to tell the story through the words of political prisoners in India. So India now does have political prisoners. And who are these political prisoners? I'm going to break them down into broadly three categories and kind of tell you how these people became political prisoners. Have you all heard of the term BK-16 or the Bhima Koregaon political prisoners in India? Okay. Okay, so the BK-16 is a group of 16 people. These are some of India's most respected scholars, thinkers, artists, activists, and poets. They've all been arrested since 2018. And they all been arrested since Narendra Modi came to power. This does not mean that India did not have political prisoners before. What really this story is that how this idea of criminalizing dissent becomes an established project, a project that is so perfect that anybody can be picked up and put in prison simply for thinking or existing. So Bhima Koregaon is, as I said, is a group of 16 activists. These are, I'm going to list their names, Sudha Bharadwaj, Arun Ferreira, Surendra Gadling, Mahesh Rawat. Mahesh Rawat, by the way, is the youngest political prisoner in India right now. He's 36 years old. And he spent the last four of his birthdays in prison for simply organizing Adivasi communities in India. Many of these communities are actually fighting the appropriation and occupation of their lands by large corporations that want to mine their lands. So you have Mahesh Rawat, Shoma Sen, Rona Wilson, Sudhir Dhawale, Vernon Gonzalez, Varvara Rao, Gautam Navlaka, Anand Tiltumde, Hani Babu, Stan Swami, who is a Jesuit priest who passed away in prison. Sagar Gorkhe, Ramesh Gaichor, and Jyoti Ghatab. These people are artists, lawyers, poets, activists, and public intellectuals, and human rights defenders. The second group of people are young Muslim men who were all picked up under the infamous FIR 59. The FIR 59 happened after the Delhi violence that took place in India in March of 2020. This was around the time when American President Donald Trump was visiting India, and there was a huge violence that breaks out. Again, this violence starts because Hindu nationalists in the heart of India actually incite violence. And this violence happens. As they incite violence, entire Muslim communities in the heart of Delhi are then completely targeted. You have up to 53 people who are dead. So vast number of people who were victims of this violence were Muslims, but the people who have been picked up were all majority Muslims. So let me again frame this to you. In the heart of India, Hindu nationalists incite violence. They call for death and murder of Muslim communities. The death and murder of Muslim communities happen, just as Donald Trump is visiting India. But the people arrested are not those who incited violence or who spoke about the hate crimes or spoke about the violence or incited the violence, but the people who are arrested are young Muslim activists in the community who are also the victims of the violence. Is everyone clear? Okay. So this is the second set of people who are arrested. Of course, this is not the complete list. The list is actually much longer. And then, of course, you have the arrests of journalists like Siddiq Kapan and others who were traveling to report a gruesome rape and murder of a young Dalit girl, and they all get again picked up. So what is it that we really see when we see all of these arrests? In all of these instances, the actual perpetrator of the actual crime, whether it is the violence, whether it is the rape, or any other kinds of hate crime, all walk free. None of the actual perpetrators have been persecuted or convicted, whereas in all of them, the state, the police, the judiciary, and the media work together to fabricate and amplify these conspiracies that indiscriminately criminalize anyone who's an activist, who's a thinker, who's a writer, who's a lawyer. So we see this pattern emerge over and over again. The police, with the tacit approval of the judiciary, let the perpetrators of heinous acts of violence and hate speech walk away while targeting individuals and entire communities affected by violence as criminals. Key witnesses die in mysterious ways. Evidence is manufactured over and over again. Again, we have proof that evidence is manufactured by the police over and over again. And the media in all of these instances, by the Indian media, I mean Indian media, that is the television media, and sometimes print media, in all of these instances, report the state's version of the story. So facts and evidence have thus became, fact and evidence no longer matters. In all of these instances, the people who have been arrested and picked up, there is actually no evidence against them. The evidence against them is either evidence that's been fabricated, or most of the evidence presented against them is evidence that's manufactured by the police, and often the witnesses to these crimes are police officers, right? So how does this come to be? For this, you need a complacent judiciary, a complicit army, a very violent police force, and obedient and subservient local authorities who kind of agree what's happening. One of the first cases that happens when Modi comes to power in 2014 is the arrest of India's this intellectual and professor in Delhi University called G.N. Sai Baba. G.N. Sai Baba is a paraplegic. He was paralyzed pretty much neck down, and he's someone who comes from a Dalit family who's educated himself under great odds. He's also someone who organized against the appropriation of Adivasi lands and what happened during Operation Green Hunt. So Sai Baba is picked up under the charge of waging war against the Indian state. But the proof of waging war against the Indian state, can someone guess what the proof of sedition or waging war against the Indian state is? It's bookshelf. He was convicted of sedition and waging war against the mighty Indian state on the basis of his bookshelf. That was all it took. And finally, after years of languishing in prison, even during the trial, Sai Baba's conviction is actually overturned by one of the middle apex courts. And the Supreme Court of India immediately gets together and the verdict is again held, which means that Sai Baba is now back in prison again. And the Indian Supreme Court Justice, M.R. Shah, says, you don't need proof to be convicted. The brain is the most dangerous. No proof or direct involvement is necessary. This was a decision that was handed down to uphold the conviction of an intellectual who, again, was convicted based on simply on the bookshelf material that he held in his house. So why is India going after these people? We wanted to tell a story of an authoritarian state. There are many ways to tell a story of an authoritarian state, and you'll listen to Hafsa talking about colonization of Kashmir. You'll talk about, listen to Azad talk about how these things go together. There are many ways to tell a story of how a nation or a country or a state becomes authoritarian or fascist. The reason we chose political prisoners is because the state is going after the very people who are fighting for the most marginalized, who are fighting for those who are really in a time where they can no longer fight for their own rights, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of bring it to an end here because I'm running out of time, but really conclude with what other things that we did in the book. This book has a list of 250 people who have been arrested and held as India's political prisoners since the day Modi came to power. And they've all been arrested under India's terror and sedition laws, many of those laws modeled after the Patriot Act that came into work here in the United States. But more importantly, we want to let you know that this is not new. Political prisoners is not something that happened when Modi first came to power. There's a long history of erosion of rights in India that predates Modi. But what you really see under the Modi regime since 2014 is that what previous governments did in the garb of the night, you have this regime do everything in the morning. As in, there is no accountability, there is no way for us to challenge it. The other things that they have done with the terror laws is that today the state can unilaterally designate anyone as a terrorist without evidence, can hold them indefinitely without trial, and the burden of proof is no longer on the state to prove that you're guilty, but it's the burden of proof is on the person to prove that you are innocent. I'm going to conclude here, and again, I'm happy to answer more questions, and there's far more to this. And of course, Jain Sai Baba is simply one of the many people, and we know about him because he's a professor, he speaks English, his wife can give press conferences. There are people that we do not know about. For instance, Pandu Narote is an Adivasi man who was convicted alongside Jain Sai Baba, who passed away in the prison because of swine flu. And his family was not told that he was sick. His lawyers were not told he was sick. We found out that he died 2 days after he died. So we also have to talk about what really happens to those who get picked up under India's terror laws and continue to languish in prison, but then do not have the means or the access to even advocate for themselves. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? Yes, okay. The louder, the better. Okay, I'll do my best. So thank you so much for attending our session today. It's particularly significant that we're here to talk about Kashmir as well as part of the many conversations that were happening, because this is a conversation and a topic that often gets either completely overlooked or ignored, especially in progressive and socialist spaces. And this is really surprising given that Kashmir is actually at the confluence of a number of issues that everyone here is committed to, whether it's abolition, anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism, anti-militarism, climate justice, indigenous rights, land rights, and sovereignty and self-determination. So if you care about any of these things, then you should also care about what's happening in Kashmir and what the people of Kashmir have been subject to for the past 75 years under India's colonial occupation. Now, I want to start off by maybe saying a little bit about why this issue might not get that much attention. And part of the reason is the place of India in the global imagination, as well as the ideas that people have about India. There's an incredible mythology around India, which ranges from the valorization of its anti-colonial history against the British and the non-violent movement led by Gandhi, who, by the way, was racist, casteist, and Islamophobic. I like speaking in these audiences, otherwise I'm like worried that someone's gonna... to its seeming anti-imperialist stance during the height of the Third World Movement, which Azad will talk about a bit as well. Given our own sometimes myopic understandings of how colonialism emerges from the global north to the global south, India's colonization of Kashmir often gets overlooked. After all, how is it possible that the country of yoga and Ayurveda could be responsible for one of the most brutal occupations of this past century? In the context of the U.S., the strength of the Indian diaspora, including in government, the academy, the media, has also been able to craft a particular narrative about Kashmir, and especially after 9/11, to posit this longstanding movement for self-determination as one of terrorism. Kashmiris have been living under India's colonial rule since 1947, following the partition of the subcontinent and the creation of the two new republics of India and Pakistan. Following the First India-Pakistan War of 1947 to 1948, the United Nations had called for a plebiscite to be held in the region, although we know that just because the United Nations says so doesn't mean that that's the only thing that grants the people the right to self-determination. It goes beyond that. Until now, that's not happened, and instead, India has used a variety of techniques to rule over Kashmir and to deny the people their right to determine their future. My recent book, Colonizing Kashmir, looks at the early decades of India's rule in Kashmir. And it basically looks at how the Indian government and the client regimes saw the Kashmir issue not in terms of political issue, obviously, of sovereignty or self-determination, but rather in economic terms, linked to a better improvement of people's standard of life. So Kashmiris were depicted as being malleable, that as long as you gave them things, that they would be happy to be under India. And that their political sentiments could be managed through state planning, development, and government policies. And so that was used both domestically, but then also internationally to normalize the occupation for the international community. And so this entailed foregrounding things like food, provision of basic services, education, et cetera. And then at the same time, questions of self-determination and people's political future were being suppressed. So this all changed in the late 1980s when, after decades of attempting to peacefully contest India's colonization, Kashmiris took up arms and a mass popular uprising began. The Indian government responded by sending over 700,000 troops who committed a number of war crimes, including rape and sexual violence, mass graves, extrajudicial killings, torture, and enforced disappearances. Since then, Kashmir remains the most militarized zone in the world. Today, nearly 1 million Indian soldiers and paramilitary forces are situated there. And through laws like the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, they have complete immunity to act how they want to without any consequences. And since the since the 1990s, almost 100,000 people have been killed. I say this to give some context because in India, it's not just the far right that's the problem, and this is really important for us to understand. There is, of course, some outcry and discomfort about the rise of Hindu nationalism and Modi and the BJP, but in situating them, one cannot ignore India's foundation as a colonial state that exercised violence at its borders, as well as within, with Dalits, tribals, religious minorities, including Muslims, Christians, and Sikhs. And all of this violence has happened under India's secular liberal governments. In 2019, India embarked on the next phase of its settler colonial project in Kashmir. Prior to this, two articles of the Indian Constitution, Article 370 and 35A, had provided some nominal autonomy to those who were considered permanent residents in Kashmir. This meant that only they could buy land and property and work in government employment. This was a deal that Kashmir's client regimes had negotiated with the Indian government that was meant to protect the region's demography and to protect the region from Indians coming in from other states and settling in Kashmir. For decades, though, Hindu nationalists have decried that this even exists because they see Kashmir as being integral to their idea of a Hindu homeland. And so once Modi was re-elected in 2019, his government revoked Kashmir's autonomy, sent in additional troops, and implemented a communication clampdown for months. This meant no internet, no phone services, no broadbands. Many of us living abroad could not get in touch with family members for months. And also arresting thousands of people in that time as well. It's not an exaggeration to say that in the past 4 years, Kashmiris have been effectively silenced, and India has changed laws that allow its citizens and armed forces and companies to buy land and property, to change the demographics in favor of Indians so that in, say, 10, 15, 20 years, the Indian government can say, well, this is not a Muslim majority region anymore, and these are not people who are calling for freedom or liberation. So Kashmir has always been used as a laboratory for different things, including the most grotesque forms of counterinsurgency. But now it's also a site of authoritarian surveillance and data collection practices, as well as resource extraction. For decades, illegal timber smuggling enabled by the Indian Army has led to massive deforestation in Kashmir. It's no surprise that some months after the revocation happened, we found out about massive lithium reserves that were found in the state. And indeed, India is now allowing its companies or its corporations unchecked access to mining in Kashmir, especially along riverbeds. And a recent report actually highlights how these companies do not follow any environmental regulations. As a result, many of the fish in Kashmir's rivers have been depleted, resulting in a loss of livelihood for many. And this mining is also leading to other environmental consequences in a region that's already very ecologically fragile. As it is, for decades, India has used Kashmir's water resources to generate electricity for its own people while Kashmiris deal with long power cuts, especially in the long and cold winter months. Kashmir's land is also under attack, both from Indian corporations and the Indian Army, which basically can now declare any land important for its security purpose and take it over, as well as investments from outside companies, including the UAE, which has begun investments to start doing real estate and malls, which is what they do best. Earlier this year, the Indian government declared large tracts of land as being illegal encroachments and attempted to take them over from the people that were living there. And they also do this using a very, a progressive language, right? So in July, the Indian government said that it was giving 1,400 square feet of land to homeless or landless people. But most of those who were homeless were actually not Kashmiris. They were outsiders, either laborers or others from India. And so here, the language of development and empowerment is basically used to further a settler colonial agenda, which we know from other contexts as well. So I want to end my talk today by talking a little bit about something I referred to earlier, this immense silencing that Kashmiris have been subject to. In recent years, the Indian government has gone after basically any and all forms of political dissent as well as documentation, from imprisoning the pro-freedom leadership to targeting writers, journalists, academics, human rights defenders, and activists in a variety of ways. Just last month, passports of dozens of Kashmiris, many of them who were journalists and academics, were revoked. Writing or saying anything that portrays the Indian government's actions in a negative light, forget even speaking about freedom or liberation, is a cause for harassment, interrogation, and imprisonment. In fact, India's leaders have used a new label, white-collar terrorists, to describe anyone who writes or speaks about its actions in Kashmir. So I am a white-collar terrorist. A number of journalists and human rights defenders are currently facing terrorism charges in jail, and the work of Kashmir's premier human rights documentation organization, the Jammu Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society, has also been criminalized and effectively shut down. So the idea is basically to completely humiliate people so that there's immense self-censorship and that the settler colonial project can progress without any pushback. So we're in a moment of profound crisis, but one that reveals the urgency to educate ourselves so that we can act collectively for what lies ahead. Part of what I want to encourage here is that so much of what India relies on is its normalization tactics, that everything is fine in Kashmir, that people only want peace, and it's only external actors like Pakistan that are causing trouble. Kashmiris in Kashmir will take time to regroup and figure out new resistance strategies to this changed reality. But at the very least that we can do in the meantime is to organize around disrupting these different normalization techniques, raise awareness, and also incorporate Kashmir into organizing in your communities. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Am I loud enough? Soft enough? Louder? So, thank you very much. Okay, so thanks a lot for coming to the session. I promise to add more blows to your mood right now. Before I start, there's a flyer going around with QR codes, and if you want more information on Hafsa's work or Suchitra's or mine, you can scan on it. There's also a notepad going around with a newsletter. You can sign up to a newsletter that I like send out once a month or so about India and Israel, stuff that does not make it into the press as such. Anyhow, so I know you want to have a robust discussion, so I'll just get to my 4 points that I wanted to make. So there's a belief among many leftists that India was pro-Palestine through the decades, and this was and that this was built from an anti-colonial impulse. Unfortunately, this is false. Yes, it's true that India demonstrated pro-Palestine sentiment prior and after the establishment of Israel. For instance, it didn't recognize Israel until 1950. It recognized the PLO and signed onto Zionism as racism at the UN in 1975. But India's purported pro-Palestine policies were linked primarily to its own interests. So first, energy interests in the Arab world. Second, its occupation in Kashmir. India did not want the Arab world to move towards Pakistan in supporting them regarding Kashmir. Third, and most importantly, its reputation in the so-called third world, meaning that India was not pro-Palestine because of an anti-colonial impulse. It did so because it understood that there was a certain currency to being seen as pro-Palestine during the anti-colonial movement, and it didn't want blowback from the Arab world if it worked closer with Israel. So in my book, Hostile Homelands, I look at Gandhi and Nehru's approach to Palestine, the contradictions that emerged with India's independence, and the letters exchanged between New Delhi and the diplomats in the Middle East when they evaluate the possible recognition of Israel in 1950. You'd be surprised, or maybe not, that the impact on Palestine is not even mentioned or featured in their discussions. One of the other aspects that has been glossed over during these years is also the relationship between Hindutva and Zionism and how Hindu nationalists looked at Zionism as an idea to replicate. So in other words, India's elite has long admired Israel, but they were hamstrung from publicly pursuing that relationship. So Modi came along and built on an existing scaffolding, an existing architecture. My second point is that it revolves around the military-industrial complex between India and Israel. You might have heard that India purchases more arms from Israel than any other country in the world. It buys around 46% of all arms sold, that Israel sells, and this is around $1 to $2 billion a year. One analyst wrote in 2010 that it probably buys more arms from Israeli companies than the Israeli army does. Now, India's arms deliveries from Israel increased by 175% between 2015 and 2019. What is really important to understand here is that India has long had a secret military relationship with Israel, at least from the 60s. So for instance, in 1962, when India and China go to war, Nehru writes to Ben-Gurion and asks for help. Ben-Gurion replies positively, and Nehru requests that the arms that he sends are sent in ships that are unmarked. So Ben-Gurion refuses, and the weapons come on Israeli ships. But this shows this duplicity from the Indian government. Israel helped in 1965 in the war against Pakistan and also in 1971 against Pakistan as well. In fact, Israel is one of the first countries that recognizes Bangladesh in 71. When Indira Gandhi became prime minister, she set up a direct line between Mossad and the Indian intelligence agency, RAW, from her office while recognizing the PLO as a legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. It happens almost at the same time. Now, the military-industrial tie-up has obviously gone through the roof, so to speak. These weapons are used in Kashmir, on the border areas in Assam, or against tribal communities in India. But the main thing here is not just the more important part here is not that India is purchasing these arms. India is now manufacturing these arms. So drones, sensors, surface-to-air missiles, other types of bombs, they are being manufactured across factories across India. This means that the U.S. sends military aid to Israel. It partially assists in them building their arms industry. The Israelis use it on Palestinians and tests it on them. And now they aren't just selling the tech to India. They are co-producing the weapons with India and therefore expanding the market to sell the weapons through India. So you can think of India as sort of mass-producing Israeli weapons. Now, the third point is how this relationship is configured into contemporary global politics. So there's a lot going on just about everywhere, right? A new scramble for the African continent, a struggle over trade routes from east to west, growing contestation over water and energy resources. And India and Israel are essentially major players in the story. So, for instance, over the past 2 years, you might have heard of the U.S. creating this or co-creating this organization or this bloc called the West Asian Bloc or the I2-U2 Bloc, comprising India, Israel, the UAE, and the U.S. This new bloc was created to do two things. First, concretize Israel's integration to the Middle East, as envisioned by the Abraham Accords, and also create a counter for China's Belt and Road Initiative. So in other words, India and Israel, along with the UAE, are going to be working together to protect U.S. interests and to protect each other. So where the normalization deals rendered the Palestinians irrelevant, the West Asia bloc would bury them completely, because these countries have begun to invest in each other's projects. So you have the UAE investing in Kashmir, as she spoke about the malls. You have the Israelis investing in India, the weapons industries. And you have the Indians investing in Israel, including in the settlements, so much so that it becomes so hard to dismantle this ecosystem that they're building. One of the first products of the West Asia bloc was the sale of the Haifa port to an Indian billionaire with close ties to Modi. So imagine an Indian flag now flies outside the Haifa port, while the Haifa port is now being geared to become a kind of a Dubai, a hyper-capitalist hub that never stops working and is never impacted by politics. So there could be a third intifada, fourth intifada, anything could be taking place in the occupied West Bank or in Gaza, but the flow of goods will not be interrupted. In other words, the occupation of Palestinians is being internationalized with multiple stakeholders, and again, India is central to that puzzle, with it now owning 70% of the port. Finally, how the U.S. is a playground for this relationship. So I have an entire chapter on the Indian diaspora in the U.S., mm-hmm. and how they worked with the pro-Israel lobby to develop the sort of political acumen in the U.S. And this is particularly fascinating for many because when you think about the rise of Indian-American politicians and the role in which they are normalizing Hindutva in the U.S., often in conjunction with Zionists. Think of Ro Khanna, who is a classic progressive except Palestine, or this new guy, Vivek Ramaswamy, this Republican candidate. And you can find Hindu nationalism sort of, you know, appearing to dictate their moves to a large extent. So it was Zionists who helped teach Hindu Americans to lobby on Capitol Hill, as petty as getting up an internship on Capitol Hill, this AIPAC. It was Zionists who helped them organize political, or helped them create political action committees. In this way, Jewish Zionist groups played a seminal role in both facilitating the relationship between Delhi and Tel Aviv, as well as in helping Hindu Americans navigate the corridors of Capitol Hill. Beyond electoral politics, there are many incidents taking place in the U.S. or have taken place in which Hindu nationalism is being normalized by Indian Americans, be it in television or in the media or in neighborhoods. Last year, for instance, in the town of Edison in New Jersey, a bulldozer was brought to an Indian Day rally or India Day rally to celebrate India's Independence Day. In recent years, the bulldozer has come to represent anti-Muslim, you know, sentiment and actions by the Indian state, because Muslim activists routinely have their homes demolished in the name of law and order in India. So the bulldozer rolled around Edison and parked outside Muslim businesses until, you know, they had to apologize for it weeks later, but the damage was done. So this type of intimidation and division is being brought to the U.S., where it already exists, of course, but it's kind of amplified. And much of it is being done in conjunction with Zionist groups in the U.S. Another example, Hafsa spoke about 2019 when India revoked Kashmir's semi-autonomous status. In New York, the Indian Consul General spoke to a group of Indians and promised them that they would be following the Israeli settler model in Kashmir, so not to worry. That video was leaked, unfortunately for him. So just as you have the ADL and the Canary Mission, you have Hindu nationalist spin-offs. Academics are threatened with rape and death threats. It's the same method that Zionists use. They've even started using Hindu phobia, you know, to kind of counter any criticism of India. In the same way, the anti-Semitism is sort of used as well. And they're also trying to create a kind of universal definition in which a critique of India is seen as anti-Hindu. And with the U.S. growing closer to India, the critiques of India are going to be more and more difficult to make. Finally, I understand that this is a lot of information, but I'd like to go to the point of solidarity, which is the point of this discussion and in many ways the point of the book as well. The book was meant to showcase how India and Israel are cooperating as well as demonstrate the sort of the mechanics driving the two ideologies and the states. It is an attempt to show how oppressors are working together and that especially in the context of declining U.S. power, the other actors who are also becoming seminal to the subjugation of Palestinians. We hear about Palestine being a laboratory where weapons are tested on Palestinians and sold to the world. India hasn't merely invested in this laboratory, they've become a satellite. So we have to be prepared for what's next, build alliances and movements across multiple liberation struggles. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.